So we'll now continue for another 45 minutes in the consideration of the book of Daniel. We're now moving to the end of chapter 3, after which comes the fascinating chapter 4. In our last study period, we're developing the thought that everything with Jesus Christ and Paul and those three worthies dependent upon their utterly refusing to let anyone take God's place as their plan maker. And it should likewise be very evident that in these last days the success of God's final work in the world depends upon the utter refusal of God's last people to let others be their plan maker in the place of the God of heaven. For this reason, the statement in Testaments to Ministers page 300 becomes more and more meaningful, where it tells us that the final work will be done contrary to any human planning, which means, of course, that God will be the great plan maker at that time when the work will be successful. I do hope by this time you begin to realize that success in life depends utterly upon our standing as Christ did, as Paul should have done, and of course as Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego did at that point of time. Today, of course, we have probationary time. Today we still have an opportunity in which to develop this kind of way of life. But the time is coming when it will be too late to develop such a character. Therefore, today we need to get busy, first of all, about developing a very, very clear understanding of these principles and learning to apply them in our day-by-day Christian experience and our church relationships, in whatever situation we find ourselves in from day to day. Now, of course, there are situations where we can obey the directives of others, as those three worthies did when they came to the golden image and when they came out of the fiery furnace at the king's command. But when it comes to laying down plans for our lives, where we shall live, what we shall do, and so forth and so on, then that is God's work and not our own. Now, once again, the king was so totally convinced by this demonstration of God's power, by the effectiveness of God's ways, by his own utter defeat in this encounter, that he gave a wonderful testimony to God's saving power. We read now this in the last verse of Daniel chapter 3. But first of all, I want to read verse 27, which talks about the reaction of the princes, governors and captains, and the king's counselors being gathered together, saw these men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Now what a witness, the very thing which King Nebuchadnezzar determined should be a powerful witness to his way, turned out instead to be a powerful witness against his way. The parallel to this is worth consideration this afternoon, because in the last days of this world's history, we will find that the attempt on the part of the King of the North, or the papacy, to demonstrate before the entire world the efficiency of his system will come to naught in the very hour of its apparent success. We'll turn back and look briefly now at the development of the seven last plagues, as related to us in the book Great Controversy. I start on page 627 of the book Great Controversy. I might do some of your lights, I think, Neil. It's getting a little dark with that curtain drawn. Thank you very much. When Christ ceases his intercession in the sanctuary, the unmingled wrath threatened against those who worship the beast in his image and receive his mark will be poured out. The plagues upon Egypt, when God was about to deliver Israel, were similar in character to those more terrible and extensive judgments which are to fall upon the world just before the final deliverance of God's people. Now, we'll just draw a diagram on the board to help us to follow this through. What we've learned so far is that the closure of Christ's ministry in the sanctuary above will initiate the outpouring of the seven last plagues. So at this point then, we have the close of probation, accomplished of course by the cessation of Christ's ministry in the sanctuary above. Then begins the seven last plagues. Likewise of course begins Jacob's trouble, as is very plainly stated in the book Patriarchs and Prophets. So I'll just give you the reference for that, because I think it's quite important to realize that both the great time of trouble and the time of Jacob's trouble commence with the closure of probation. Now, the statement is concerned, of course, with Jacob's wrestling again with the angel. Just going to see it here quickly. Yep, page 201 in the book Patriarchs and Prophets. Jacob's experience during that night of wrestling and anguish but represents the trial through which the people of God must pass just before Christ's second coming. The prophet Jeremiah, in holy vision, looking down to this time, said, "We have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, not of peace. All faces are turned into paleness. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even a time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. When Christ shall cease his work as mediator in man's behalf, then this time of trouble will begin. When Christ shall cease his work as mediator in man's behalf, then this time of trouble, namely Jacob's trouble, will begin." Now you recognize, of course, that Jacob's trouble is different from the experience of the wicked in the great time of trouble. The time of Jacob's trouble is a time of very deep spiritual anguish, as the people search their hearts to make certain that all sin has been sent on beforehand to judgment. Whereas the time of trouble that the wicked suffer is a time of physical torment, mainly from the outpouring of the seven last plagues. Now, Sister White lists the plagues in their order through 1 through 4 on page 628 of the book Great Controversy. Says the Revelator, in describing those terrific scourges, "There fell a noisome and grievous sore upon the men which had the mark of the beast and upon them which worshipped his image." That's plague number 1. "The sea became as above a dead man, and every living soul died in the sea." That's plague number 2. "And the rivers and fountains of water became blood." That's plague number 3. And then there's some comment upon that. The next paragraph opens with these words, "In the plague that follows, power is given to the sun to scorch men with fire, and men are scorched with great heat." The plague which follows, of course, being the fourth plague. The next paragraph then says, "These plagues are not universal, or the inhabitants of the earth would be wholly cut off." When it says "these plagues," it does not say "the," but "these plagues are not universal," which means the first four are limited to certain areas of the earth. In fact, I think that they will fall in different areas of the earth, otherwise the place where they fell would denude the earth, the population there. Now, throughout the remainder of this chapter, there is no reference at all to plague 5, which is the darkness that falls upon the seed of the beast and fills his kingdom with darkness, plague 6, which is drying up of the great river Euphrates, and plague 7, which of course is the outpouring of the hail and the dreadful earthquake. Not a word about that in the rest of the chapter. The rest of the chapter is devoted to describing the effects of those first four plagues: famine, desolation, pestilence, starvation, death, fearful fires that burn unrestrained across past wilderness areas, created such, of course, by the burning sun, dried up lakes and rivers, and so forth. But now we come to the next chapter, entitled God's People Delivered, chapter 40, beginning on page 635. And now we find, opened up before us, the description of the fifth, the sixth and the seventh plagues. And we're most concerned right now about the fifth and the sixth. "When the protection of human law shall be withdrawn from those who honor the law of God, there will be in different lands a simultaneous movement for their destruction." Now let's pause right there for a moment. A statement which helped me to understand the order of last day events is curious enough in the book Desire of Ages. Well, I'll read this simple sentence, which really helped us to understand the principle involved in the succession of events in the close-up of human history. Now, I just lost track of it for a moment, pardon me. Yeah, page 121 and 122. "In the last great conflict of the great controversy," a bit of the controversy with Satan, those who are loyal to God will see every earthly support cut off. Because they refuse to break his law in obedience to earthly powers, they will be forbidden to buy or sell. It will finally be decreed that they shall be put to death. Now, first of all, it says, because they refuse to break his law in obedience to earthly powers, then comes the buy and sell decree. Now, this means, then, that there must be a law to disobey, after which comes the buy and sell decree. Now, we know, of course, that when probation closes, the image of the beast already has been formed. My diagram, of course, is dealing here with the period after probation, so I need to extend this a little bit to get this picture quite clear. With the setting up of the image of the beast, we have the Sunday law. When the Sunday law is first passed, it is not directed against God's two people. Rather, it'll be a measure taken by human beings to solve the mounting problem caused by the increasing disasters and desolations resulting from more and more trouble coming upon the earth. So now make the Sunday law in order to get God's approval. They'll say, Lord, we've done this for you, that you do something for us. Now, when the Sunday law is made, the people of God begin to protest it in the mighty power of the Spirit, and they will, of course, disobey it. People of God will disobey that law because it is a human plan, a human solution. Because they do, they will then be imposed upon them the buy and sell decree. Now, with the diagram now building on the board, let me read the sentence again so get this picture quite clear in your minds. It says, because they refuse to break his law in obedience to earthly powers, they will be forbidden to buy or sell. The law is made, then comes disobedience, then comes the next restriction. It will finally be decreed they should be put to death. So in the end, there comes a death decree against them. And a death decree is imposed just before the close of probation. But the date for its execution is sometime later. So over here we find the date for its execution. So now we'll put the close of probation at this point. And then, as I read a moment ago, we find the first, the second, the third, and the fourth plagues fall in their order, one after the other. Then I read to you from page 635 where it says, when the protection of human law shall be withdrawn from those who honour the law of God, there will be in different lands, pardon me, a simultaneous movement for their destruction. As the time appointed in the decree draws near, the people will conspire to root out the hated sect. It will be determined to strike in one night a decisive blow which shall utterly silence the voice of dissent and reproof. The people of God, some in prison cells, some hidden in solitary retreats in the forests and the mountains, still plead for divine protection, while in every quarter companies of armed men, urged on by hosts of evil angels, are preparing for the work of death. It is now in the hour of utmost extremity that the Lord, that the God of Israel, will interpose for deliverance of his chosen. Saith the Lord, you shall have a song, as in the night when a holy solemnity is kept, and gladness of heart as when one goeth to come into the mountain of Jehovah, to the mighty one of Israel. And the Lord shall cause his glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lighting down of his arm, when the indignation of his anger, and when the flame of devouring fire was scattering in tempest and hailstones. With shouts of jeering, with shouts of triumph, jeering and imprecation, throngs of evil men are about to rush upon their prey, when lo, a dense blackness, deeper than the darkness of the night, falls upon the earth. Now let's just try and draw the picture here now, what is happening at this point of time. Here are the people of God bowed in prayers, the only defense that they've got at this point of time. Here are the wicked rushing up to slay them with the weapons raised to bring down over their shoulderless heads. And of course, in the background, the ministry is urging on these people to carry out their work of destruction. In other words, this is the seas, the peoples. This, of course, these are the saints of God, and this is the woman, or the beast, or in short, Babylon the Great. And the people, of course, are there to do the bidding of this awesome king who rules over all the earth. Now, that King Babylon will by this time have gained supremacy over the entire world, excepting for the little company standing in the lights. And they'll be a little company. There are only four back in Daniel's day who stood there to withstand the King of Babylon. Not one other person upon the plains of Judah stood up against the decree of the king. Daniel, of course, obviously was not there, otherwise he'd have stood too. His personal test came later in the lion's den. Now, in the very instant of time when the swords are about to fall, this blackness falls upon the scene and simply blots out the whole picture. Now remember, it's already midnight when this thing takes place. It tells us that a little further down the same page. And therefore, in their search for the people of God and the discovery of them, the wicked must be using some kind of torches or flashlights, as the case may be. Wouldn't be surprised if it'd be torches rather than flashlights, because so broken down will industry be at that time that it might be difficult to find batteries. In any case, we'll have some form of illumination. But when that darkness falls, it is so dense, so intense, that their torches do not penetrate that darkness at all. And the people have got it blotted from their view. When that takes place, at that point of time, then obviously we have the fifth plague. That darkness is the fifth plague. Now, see how close Satan comes to gaining complete triumph in his determination to destroy God's people and establish himself as a sole supreme ruler of this planet. One more second is always required to bring those weapons down and wipe God's people off the face of the earth and leave him the undisputed possessor and ruler of this world. Then comes that blackness. Then a rainbow, shining with the glory from the throne of God, spans the heavens and seems to encircle each praying company. The angry multitudes are suddenly arrested. Their mocking cries die away. The objects of their murderous rage are forgotten. With fearful forebodings, they gaze upon the symbol of God's covenant and long to be shielded from its overpowering brightness. In other words, in the moment of apparent triumph comes total and complete defeat for the Babylonian power. And when we come back to the burning fiery furnace, when King Nebuchadnezzar threw those three men into the furnace, then to all appearances, what had he achieved? Total triumph. He wiped out the people of God. They didn't exist anymore. And now he was the unchallenged, undisputed ruler of the world, and every other person was bowing before his precious golden image. And then in that moment of apparent triumph, he finds that God's people are still very, very much alive. And so likewise, in the last days will come just as close again, when in the moment of apparent triumph, he shall come to his end with none to help him. Now let's examine Daniel 11 verse 45 for a moment, which says, and he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas. Pardon?
In the glorious holy mountain between the seas.
Between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, isn't it?
In the glorious holy mountain between the seas.
I think it's between the seas. Just let's see what it says. No, it says between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. In this book. It said, he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas. Now the next word should be and. In is a mistranslation. Between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, he shall come to his end and none shall help him. Let's examine this verse for a moment. Let's ask ourselves, we've already learned from our study what here we have the glorious holy mountain. Here we have the seas, and it says he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace. And palace, of course, means the seat of authority, because kings reign in palaces. Now, in Bible prophecy, what do seas represent?
People.
Right, people. Good. That's very simple and clear. We learned this morning what a mountain in Bible prophecy symbolizes. kingdom. Good. So there then is the kingdom. But this is the glorious holy kingdom. So whose kingdom must it be, God's or Satan's? Obviously it's God's kingdom. Now, his palace symbolizes his authority, Satan's authority, the king of the north, which of course basically is Satan. So then here we have his authority. When Satan does that, and he almost succeeds, and he would succeed if he was able to wipe God's people off the face of the earth, then he has come before God and says, now he says to God, you must accept my kingdom, because I have established myself at the head of the peoples of this earth. I have successfully displaced you, and therefore you must accept me. But the problem still remains that there is no connection between Satan and the source. There can never be, because Christ has been displaced and Christ is the connector. And you take away the connector, then there's no connection, is there? That's impossible. Now, at the very moment of apparent crime, it says, he shall come to his end and none shall help him. In other words, God is placed in the fortunate position where he has to make no decision about the matter. He doesn't have to say to Satan, well, all right, I have to consider this or whatever. God doesn't have to do a thing, because in a moment of apparent triumph, the whole thing absolutely falls to pieces. Completely and totally so. Now, up until this point of time, Satan has tried again and again to establish upon this earth a universal government of this nature. But always there has been a faithful remnant who have resisted his supremacy, or he has found the king of the south, atheism, to be a very strong contender against his plans and ambitions. But now in the last days, he will, through the papacy, actually gain control of the entire world, excepting for a little company standing in the light. The entire world. And after all said and done, this will be again what it was back in Nebuchadnezzar's day. Because how much of the world did Nebuchadnezzar rule? All of it. And when it came to the golden image, how many bowed to it? Everybody, excepting for three men. That's all. And those King Nebuchadnezzar determined he would wipe off the face of the earth by burning them in the burning fiery furnace. So likewise in these last days, Satan determined to wipe off the face of the earth the little company standing in the light, and then he would go before God and say, now I have won the great controversy upon this earth, I am now in possession and authority here, and therefore you have to recognize me. But in that moment of apparent triumph, the whole thing absolutely falls to pieces. Now let me read on a little further, on page 654 and 5 and 6 of the same book, Great Controversy, where Sister White now describes not the experience of the righteous, but the experience of God's people in this final showdown. And here are people who throughout the whole affair have steadfastly refused to allow man to become their plan makers. They'll not bow to any image, they won't keep Sunday, they'll follow God's plan of faithfully keeping the Sabbath day and leaving God in his rightful place. Page 654 in the Great Controversy. When the voice of God turns the captivity of his people, there is a terrible awakening of those who have lost all in the great conflict of life. And save time, I'll pass on to page 655. Now it says, the people see that they have been deluded. Now you appreciate the fact, of course, that Satan is not the sin master. Sin is the sin master. And Satan is only able to hold control of this earth by deception. It'll be worth my while to notice with you a statement which makes this point very, very clear. On page 624 of the same book, Great Controversy, fearful sights of a supernatural character will soon be revealed in the heavens in token of the power of miracle-working demons. The spiritual devils will go forth to the kings of the earth and to the whole world to fasten them in deception, and urge them on to unite with Satan in his last struggle against the government of heaven. By these agencies, rulers and subjects will be alike deceived. Persons will arise pretending to be Christ himself and claiming the title and worship which belong to the world's Redeemer. They will perform wonderful miracles of healing and will profess to have revelations from heaven contradicting the testimony of the Scriptures. And note the words, it says, the spiritual devils will go forth to the kings of the earth and to the whole world to fasten them in deception. and urged them on to unite with Satan in his last struggle against the government of heaven. Now, in other words, there are only two ways by which Satan can rule the world. First of all, by deception, he has to secure the power of the state and the power of the church, and then by deception cause these to unite, so churchcraft and statecraft intermingle, as does the iron and the clay and the feet of the image. And then he uses them, and then he uses them to coerce the rest of the world. So first by deception, and then by force, Satan seeks to bring the whole world under his command. And he's very successful in doing this. But when the fifth plague comes, and that great river, the great river Euphrates, dries up, which is the sixth plague, let me read here where it says on page 655, the people see that they have been deluded. Now, when you deceive a person over a given point of time, and that person comes to recognize that you have deceived him, then while during the period of deception that person has trustingly followed you, when that person found that you have been deceiving him, how then will he relate to you? Does he then become very friendly? Or does he become very vindictive and angry towards you? And the answer is obvious. You deceive a person, and when they find you out, then of course they turn against you. I read further. They accuse one another of having led them to destruction, but all unite in heaping their bitterest condemnation upon the ministers. Unfaithful pastors have prophesied smooth things. They have led their hearers to make void the law of God and to persecute those who would keep it holy. Now, in their despair, these teachers confess before the world their work of deception. The multitudes are filled with fury. We are lost, they cry, and you are the cause of our ruin. And they turn upon the false shepherds. The very ones that once admired them most will pronounce the most dreadful curses upon them. The very hands that once crowned them with laurels will be raised for their destruction. The swords which were to slay God's people are now employed to destroy their enemies. Everywhere there is strife and bloodshed. And so Satan's kingdom falls apart from within. The people see they've been deluded, and then these very people who to slay God's people turn around and slay instead the ministers and leaders who urged them on in their work of destruction. And so is fulfilled the words, he shall come to his end and none shall help him. No longer do the people help Satan because they see they have been deceived. The ministers confess their work of deception. They're no more use to Satan, and Satan finds himself absolutely isolated at that point of time. None to support him in any shape or form whatsoever. And so, just as the scheme employed by Nebuchadnezzar to establish the golden image utterly failed because of the faithfulness of that little company back then, so Satan's scheme in the last days to assert his authority and establish himself as king will fail because everyone will withdraw their support from him. Now come back to Daniel chapter 3 again, and we'll notice the reaction of the king and the procedure he now took to in response to this whole experience. We'll start with verse 28. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own god. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Now I have to really smile, you know, to take this of the king, because he was, by making this plan or this decree, actually condemning himself to death. Because he was doing the very thing the decree forbade him to do. He was literally speaking against the God of heaven, although apparently he was speaking for the God of heaven. Let's examine what is meant by this. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar recognized the fact that God was, at that time and is today of course, the only rightful sovereign over this world. He also recognized the fact that the people throughout his vast dominions were not converted simply by the exhibition of God's power in delivering Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he therefore recognized that there would be a very real danger of these men continuing, these subjects continuing in their opposition to the God of heaven. And so therefore he said, well, I must solve this problem. So he then devised a plan. He then passed a decree to help God out in the establishment of his government. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar would be God's agent to enforce the worship of God by all these people. Now, was he on the right track? By no means, because he was busy making plans, he was busy building up God's kingdom after man's methods. And really speaking, he was doing no better now in enforcing the worship of God than he'd done previously in enforcing the worship of the image. Now, God does not want to be worshipped only, but he needs to be worshipped in the right way. And therefore, any effort upon the part of any person to coerce men into worshipping the true God even is no better than seeking to coerce men into worshipping the false God. However, what I do appreciate in the story of Daniel is the unfailing love of the God of heaven, who worked with great patience to bring that king step by step to a true understanding of his need and to finally effect the conversion of the king of Babylon. I read that to you, of course, in the Bible commentary. I'll read it once more on page 1170 of volume 4. King Nebuchadnezzar, before whom Daniel so often honored the name of God, was finally thoroughly converted and learned to praise and extol and honor the king of heaven. He was finally converted. And that I would say has to be possibly the greatest conversion of human history. To match it today, we'd have to go to Rome and convert the present pope. Got to try it? that would match it, because Nebuchadnezzar was literally the pope of that day, wasn't he? He was the king of Babylon and the leader of that vast Babylonian system down here in the world below. Now, we come now to the fourth chapter of Daniel, in which is outlined the final conversion of King Nebuchadnezzar. And this chapter was written by Nebuchadnezzar himself. He addresses us in this statement, which has been included in the book of Daniel. This part is not written by Daniel or by anyone else but the king himself. Verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. How great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom and his dominion is from generation to generation. So there's Nebuchadnezzar's testimony. And now the rest of the chapter is devoted to telling us how he came at last to the place we could give that kind of testimony. Verse 4. Now the story proceeds. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts upon my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore I made a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then came in the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers, and I told the dream before them, but they did not make known to me the interpretation thereof. So Nebuchadnezzar's performing as usual, isn't he? After all these experiences, he still doesn't turn first of all to the man of God, but he turns first of all to the Babylonian magicians and so forth, who had failed him so utterly in the past, and who stood for principles that had been manifestly shown to have built into them the elements of failure. But this time the king doesn't get furious, at least there's no record of it. And with a kind of a sigh, as if to say, well, I ought to have known better anyway, he calls Daniel, as you read in verse 8. But at the last, Daniel came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and before him I told the dream, saying. And now comes the dream. O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee, and no secret troubleth thee, tell me the visions of my dream that I have seen and the interpretation thereof. Thus for the visions of mine head in my bed I saw, and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and the height thereof was great. The tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. The leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. Before I go any further, we do know, of course, from prior study that the tree symbolized Nebuchadnezzar himself. And in this verse, as the king saw in the dream, is shown a picture of his true role as the king of Babylon. And that true role was to be a protector and a provider for the people throughout the length and breadth of his kingdom. Not one who drew out of them wealth for himself, but one who served these people in love as God in turn serves his subjects. I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and holy one came down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, hew down the tree and cut off his branches, shake off his leaves and scatter his fruit. Let the beasts get away from under it and the fowls from his branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him. This matter is by the decree of the watchers, and a demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, declare the interpretation thereof, forasmuch as all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known unto me the interpretation, but thou art able, for the Spirit of the holy gods is in thee. And before we look at Daniel's interpretation, or God's interpretation to Daniel, let's examine for a few moments some principles back there in verse 17, which I think should be clearly understood. It says, this matter is by the decree of the watchers and a demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will and setteth up over it the basis to men. Does God arbitrarily decide who shall rule here and who shall rule there? In other words, did God make up his mind to put Hitler in Nazi Germany before and during the Second World War? If God chose that man and put him in that place, then is not God responsible for the atrocity which that man committed? Very obviously. Did God put Nero as a personal choice upon the throne of Rome when he destroyed so many Christians and so many Romans too for that matter? Again, not in the sense of personal election of that man. In what sense then is it true that God sets these men in these places? Pardon?
He permits it.
He permits it, is right. But more than that, it is by God's power misused that they acquire those positions. Now think today of the power possessed by America, and the power in their warplanes, in their tanks, in their battleships, in their armies. The power that they wield in the business world, the power which we find in fuel, the power of electricity and all these things. Now, from whence alone comes all that power? From God. There's no other source but God. Now, the way in which that power is used depends upon the character and intentions of the men who use that power. Now, when they use that power for self-glorification and self-exaltation and self-supremacy, then because they have used God's powers to achieve it, in that sense it can be said that God set them up in that sense. Of course, in reality, they set themselves up in this thing. But now the message that God desired to convey to King Nebuchadnezzar was that it was by the outworking of law, the exercise of power given him from God and misused by him, that he came into this position of supremacy. But inexorably, the misuse of law comes to the place where it becomes a destroyer of the misuser. So that the saying is fulfilled, is spoken by Jesus Christ, that those who live by the sword shall die by the sword. The only way to safely possess and use the power of God, of course, is within the framework of God's laws and God's principles. Otherwise, power becomes a terrible destroyer. That's the way it's always been, and that, of course, in turn is the way in which it always will be. Now, Nebuchadnezzar suffered a nervous breakdown of such proportions it took 7 years to recover, as we'll learn in more detail in our next study period. That nervous breakdown, that mental derangement, was not something which God personally inflicted upon Nebuchadnezzar. It was rather the outworking in that man of his rejection of God's loving appeals. Now, when you consider the experiences which Nebuchadnezzar went, first of all over the matter of the bread and the wine, the meat and the wine, then over the matter of the examination, the tremendous trauma he went through over the revelation of the vision of Daniel 2, the erection of the image in Daniel 3 in the burning fiery furnace. Now, in the day-by-day contact he had with Daniel and his three companions, there was placed upon that man a tremendous spiritual pressure to yield his life to God and to accept God's ways and prosper by them. But as we saw, he kept resisting those things and turning back to his own way, and that resistance imposed upon him a mental and nervous pressure which finally resulted in, as a natural matter of course, in his complete nervous breakdown, which deprived him of his kingdom for 7 years. Now, I firmly believe that he would have lost the kingdom forever, but for the power of Daniel, who no doubt, having no aspirations for personal aggrandizement and glory and not desiring to be the king of Babylon for certain, kept that kingdom safe and intact until the king returned after his period of exile from the court, after his sojourn out there with the animals and so forth. More and more, I am very, very deeply impressed with the fact that everything in life is the outworking of the laws which God has established in the world. We need to understand those things. Those of us who learn God's ways, as a matter of course, enter into God's rest. Those who don't understand God's ways, as a matter of course, do not enter into God's rest, but instead they experience continual unrest and deprivation of peace and quietude. And the better we understand the role of law in all these things, the better we're able to appreciate the ways of God and to participate in the building of God's kingdom in God's way. And there we pause until our next study period.